This week, Bitcoin blasted higher with the ETF adding 65% in a single week, and gold and silver plus the Dow Jones put holiday smiles on investors' faces. It's a pleasure to rejoin you, your host, Chris Waltzek, with another edutainment-packed show and, as usual, two all-new guest interviews. Well, yet another explosive week for the crypto markets on dollar weakness helped ignite the next explosive leg higher plus Bitcoin futures. You know, it's hard to imagine just how many new global millionaires are out there with Cheeto stains on their fingers living in their mom's basement, shopping for new video games on Amazon with some of their BTC fortune. Charles Hughes Smith shares my enthusiasm for the cryptos. He made a prescient call of 17,000, which just came to pass recently, way back when it was under 1,000. Charles Hughes Smith from Of Two Minds returns nothing but positive comments on the crypto bonanza. The real-world peer-to-peer Bitcoin applications are resulting in an exceptional explosion in utility for all global inhabitants. And we record the interview on the studio workstation running two GPUs, which actually paid for our electricity costs. Bitcoin is very similar to precious metals in that it's a phenomenal store of value. It's highly divisible. In fact, it set the standard, you might say, in divisibility. Extremely transferable, probably more so than any other precious metal. And it has a very high security level, thanks, of course, to Satoshi Nakamoto. And could this be a real-time failure of the global fiat currency system? We examine all of these topics plus more. Then John Embry, senior strategist of Sprott Asset Management, returns to the show after nearly a two-year hiatus. He thinks that the crypto explosion indicates gold price suppression and that the eruption we've seen in Bitcoin and related Ethereum and Litecoin and many others, including Ripple just this week, could present a petri dish model for the precious metals. And we'd like for you to call into our Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, followed by extension number 514049. Please jot down the number and call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Plus, if you're looking for a stocking stuffer this year and you'd like to support the show as well as receive the Alpha Stocks Bitcoin newsletter, we're still offering a free Trezor wallet, which manages most of the cryptocurrencies as well as Bitcoin with a digital readout display. It's just the best cold storage around with every 5-year and 10-year subscription. And if you sign up for a 1-year annual subscription, we're offering Ledger wallets. We've already given away at least 12 or 13, plus one Trezor this week. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with another must-hear report as we approach our 12th consecutive year online. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Visibility was virtually unlimited over the precious metals market on Friday as the dollar rally faded on buy the Fed rate hike rumors sell the dollar fact. The greenback fell well below key long-term support in the Fed's third rate hike of the year. Gold added $9, finishing at $12.57, up about 10% for the year, while silver picked up 24, ending at $16.06, near the break-even point. The precious metals XAU shares declined 2.72, ending at $76.93. Black gold finished near the break-even point at $57.33 per barrel. The big story, after hitting another new high, the Bitcoin ETF added $1,050 in a single week, closing at $2,700. That's up 64% for the week and 2,600% for the year. That's right, if you had invested $10,000 at the beginning of the year when we first started recommending it, that would be worth $250,000 at least. Meanwhile, demand from India for the precious metals is expected to be a big driver in the new year, according to one media report. Plus, holiday purchases tend to boost prices. The increase in U.S. and global share prices also suggests solid economic output, which could spill over into the overall inflation levels in the coming months and years ahead, particularly in Asia, where growth rates remain astronomical and demand for precious metals red hot. Precious metals bottom line. Well, gold tends to do very well in January and February before before falling off in March, and this is really one of the most reliable cycle indicators around. But like any research, there are provisos. We're still fighting the risk-on trade, with U.S. shares breaking out to new highs. One market watcher this week noted that we could see the metal hit $1,700 an ounce in 2018, about a $450 rally on positive COT data. Plus, positive technicals continue to suggest that the bullish head and shoulders patterns in gold and silver could catapult prices higher. In addition, the current Fed funds futures rate indicates no further rate hikes until September of next year. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange as domestic shares moved higher on tame inflation numbers and a slightly dovish FOMC comments. The Dow Jones picked up 322, closing at 24,651. The S&P added another 24, ending at 2675, and the NASDAQ added nearly 100 at 6936. Meanwhile, the top story moving the markets this week, the U.S. Federal Reserve decision to raise rates went off as expected the third of the year, and they lifted the overnight lending rate to a range of 1.25% to 1.5%, offering forward guidance in line with expectations for three more rate hikes next year, but really very thin odds of that currently at the Fed funds futures. I don't expect more than two next year, and maybe as few as just one. Plus, policymakers noted the rather low inflation numbers in the consumer price index, which just inched higher last month. U.S. shares, bottom line. Well, we certainly eclipsed my 24,000 Dow forecast, which now puts the next consolidation projection 25 or even 26,000. The 7 indicator greed index remains in the greedy category, but there are a few signs of excessiveness. So even with the rocket move higher this week, there's still more momentum potentially ahead, and positive seasonal factors as the holidays approach tend to remain very solid. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. It's just a pleasure to welcome Charles Hughes Smith back to the show of Two Minds. Just a fantastic must-read blog, plus, of course, a best-selling author. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chris. It's my pleasure.
You've really, like some of us, caught Bitcoin crypto fever, but it seems like investors today really only fall into one of two camps. They either get Bitcoin or they don't. It's interesting to watch, I think, as the light bulbs start to, you know, warm up. Tell us what turned that light on for Charles Hughes Smith.
Right. Well, that's a great question, Chris, because we all have a learning curve, or the vast majority of us have a very steep learning curve in trying to understand what cryptocurrencies are and their functionality or their utility. And for me, the light bulb, I knew about Bitcoin. Readers, of course, are always much smarter than I am. So they told me about it back in 2010 and 11 and 12, and I'd been following it sort of academically. But I hired some translators to translate one of my books located in South America, and I needed to pay them in Bitcoin because there's really no better way to transfer funds to pay for people doing digital services globally except cryptocurrencies. And so then I started to realize how easy it was to pay people globally for doing work for you. And the fee was, I mean, the transaction fee was something like $4.50 compared to, you know, trying to wire, you know, money, and then it takes days and costs a lot of money. And, you know, it's just the utility value is really high. And that's what I think a lot of people don't understand that haven't used it yet.
The computers that are recording our voices here today have actually been dedicated and optimized. The GPUs, that is, the graphical processors, have been optimized. We've got a GTX 1070 and a Zotac 1060, which is weaker, but it's one of my favorites simply because it has so many CUDA cores. What's ironic is I used to run the studio here off my 1 kilowatt 10 solar panel. It's about 1,000 watt production. You know, fast forward a couple of years, things have changed so much. We're actually paying for the studio electricity and heating right now simply with the computers that are recording our voices. Actually mining Zcash right now, hashing about 800 or 900 sols. You know, Bitcoin, it may be a store of value. That's debatable. Probably the greatest transfer of wealth in maybe 200 years. But it's definitely a network. I've heard arguments on both sides I'd like to get into. Nassim Taleb pointed out this could be worth zero, it could be worth 100,000. It's impossible to truly short. The more overlooked aspect, the real value, the tangible intrinsic value of Bitcoin and the cryptos stems from A, the number of users, and B, the average daily transactions. So we're looking at a revolution here on many levels, not just as a currency. It's really the sum total.
I think you did a great summary by touching on a variety of the sources of value in Bitcoin and to some degree the other major cryptocurrencies, which is there's a utility value, there's a network effect value, there's a store of value. Also, in the fact that Bitcoin and most of the other major cryptos are limited in the number of coins that will be issued. And of course, as we see central banks creating 14 trillion units of their currencies out of thin air, we start wondering, what's the consequence of actually having a currency or a commodity, whatever, however you want to describe it, that's intrinsically limited by the math, as opposed to a little click of meets in a secret room, opaquely decides how much currency to issue and to whom. That's the central bank system. A little click of folks in a secret room deciding how much currency to create, to whom to distribute it to.
As you pointed out, it's an inefficient, it's a non-transparent, or as you say, opaque way of distributing wealth. I'm referring to the fiat system. And ultimately, it fails. I mean, to any, I think, student of the Austrian school knows that Mises and von Hayek and all the rest have done a seminal job pointing out how these systems will fail. And are we seeing in real time de facto failure of fiat currencies? This revolution in Bitcoin, is it emblematic of the end of paper money?
Well, that's a great question, Chris. Some proponents like Max Keiser are saying that it's not so much that Bitcoin and the cryptocurrencies are rising so much, it's that the fiat currencies are losing value relative to the cryptocurrencies. And so that's an interesting point to consider, is that where is the value proposition in a currency that can be generated in the trillions at will? But it's centralized. In other words, we don't get to pony up, get our $1 billion of free money from the Federal Reserve, right? It only goes to this centralized private banking sector and financiers. And so what I liked about your example of the way that you're mining cryptocurrency as we speak, that element of it is very decentralized. In other words, it's not only distributed, the blockchain's not only distributed over a universe of processors. There's a lot of ways for individuals or households or communities to start participating in this at the ground level.
Is this a bubble? You know, I think we both could probably make a case.
I think we have two dynamics in play that are overlaid on each other, so it's hard to separate. There is a speculative frenzy in the crypto space. In other words, you see it in tokens that are of, let's just say, questionable value, you know, going up fivefold in a few days. You know, that kind of speculative typically marks euphoric type of speculative bubbles, right? But if we set aside the speculative bubble part and the sort of frenzy, there is real value here, and that is still in development. In other words, I've already used Bitcoin to conduct business. It works for me. I'm convinced of its utility value from my own experience. Many other people haven't had that yet, and other people are waiting for things like the Ethereum smart contract system to become present in everyday life, right? So we're not quite there yet on a lot of the uses that people foresee for blockchain technologies and cryptocurrencies. But it's the potential is so obvious that we have to kind of separate out that real value from the speculative frenzy part of the thing. And so you could say, well, yeah, the bubbles in lesser known cryptocurrencies or tokens, that could blow up and go the way of all bubbles, while the high utility, high value primary cryptos, you know, Monero, Dash, Ethereum, Bitcoin, to name a few, possibly Ripple, once these establish themselves in the real economy, then their utility value and their network value will only increase. As to what that price will be, I don't know. I did a calculation and put an estimate on Bitcoin back when it was about $1,000. I put a target of 17,000. And you might say, well, how did I just do that? Reach into a hat of, you know, random numbers. And I said, no, I thought I base that on, if 0.1% of the financial wealth sloshing around the global economy found a home in Bitcoin, then that would lead to a price of $17,000 per Bitcoin. It just so happens that it did hit 17,000 and many years earlier than I anticipated.
We are looking now at Bitcoin as digital gold. And so we have about a $7 to $8 trillion gold market. Right now, we're only in the neighborhood of $250 billion. So, you know, back of the envelope math puts you around 30 to 32 fold higher as a potential target. And admittedly, that's a stretch.
Well, that's a great, I think, contextualization of the question you've raised, which is how do you value something that's such a new technology that has such great potential and is yet unknown, right? And so the way that you described it is one excellent way, which is more a technological extrapolation of value based on metrics. My idea was based on a more financial metric, which was to take the pool of financial assets that are floating around the world economy, which is around $300 trillion. That's the total value of stocks, bonds, and derivatives, mortgage-backed securities, you name it, all the financial wealth. Real estate's another $200 trillion. So roughly $500 trillion in total financial assets out there. If 1% decided to find a home in Bitcoin, just the financial wealth, not the real estate, then you're talking about, 1% of $300 trillion, which would be $1 trillion, right? And so, right now, yeah, Bitcoin's market cap is 250 to 300 million or something, right? So, just kind of back of the envelope, you're talking about a tenfold increase with just a little tiny bit of all the global wealth.
And you're exactly right. That would be a tenfold increase because you were talking about 300 trillion or roughly 1% multiply 300 billion today times 10.
Yeah. And so the thing I think that I would like to make two quick points here for you to, we're used to fiat currency being both a store of value and a means of exchange. Those are two functions of money. But I can foresee, and other people see the same thing, that in the cryptocurrency space, there might be a few currencies such as Bitcoin itself that are more a store of value, that they're not going to be traded for a cup of coffee. They'll be saved for larger transactions, and there'll be other forms of cryptocurrency which are used for day-to-day consumer.
Has Bitcoin outgrown itself? Because remember, the original promise was cheap, quick transactions. Now we're looking at $4, $5, $10 for what? You can't buy a cup of coffee. The transaction fee is $2, $3, $4, $5 if you're lucky, and it's going to take 45 minutes to make the transaction. So you are right. Now, Bitcoin Cash is the alternative, and I think you actually sort of touched on that. You started to before the discussion. Probably an easier block size to mine, a better hash rate, facilitating smaller transactions with much lower fees. But I question whether or not that will hold out for long, because as these increase in price, they tend to increase in difficulty in the hash rates and the mining, slowly inches up the transaction costs, and we find ourselves right back where we were. But you know what? There's an infinite number of alternatives here. My favorite is Interzone, which ITZ, which I've got everyone buying. I think last time I checked, it was a fraction of a penny. I think there's a global revolution that's going to take off around Interzone. The secret is that everybody can have a masternode who wants one for like $100, and you get instantaneous transactions with zero costs. And I believe that the developing world, Africa, the Southern Hemisphere in particular, Asia, pennies really do matter. Southern India, your only bank account is on an iPhone, and anyone can have a bank account who can walk into a library barefoot and set up an Interzone wallet. They will fill that void. Sure, you can slice and dice it up into a Satoshi, the smallest increment, 8 decimal places. You still have to pay the hefty transaction.
Well, Chris, I think what your point is excellent, because people who are poor, they're partly poor because they have high transaction costs and no access to credit or banking. And so these micro payment cryptocurrencies that you're describing are a key part of reducing poverty globally.
I'd like to make a comparison with gold, and that is that when we start to compare the number of Bitcoin, which is almost exactly 16.7 million outstanding, for a Bitcoin to be valued against an ounce of gold, it's about $1.2 million per Bitcoin. Trying to convince people that a digital signature in the ether realm is somehow equivalent to what they have stored under the floorboards in their house in a fireproof safe, that's a hard sell. But as I think you've already alluded to earlier in the discussion, there are some stark similarities between Bitcoin and precious metals.
Chris, that's a great topic, and you outlined it just right, which is that it is a hard sell. Naturally, we all feel that tangible stuff has a reality that digital stuff doesn't quite match, right? So gold and silver have tangible qualities, and they have time-tested, you know, 3,000 years or 5,000 years of being used as money and all that. And so how can a digital string be more valuable than something tangible? And I think that my basic answer is you have to look at the utility value of money. Money is a social construct. We assign value to things to act as money. And as we all know, this over time and human history, this includes salt, cowrie shells, notch sticks, giant rocks 6 feet high with a hole carved in the middle. All kinds of stuff acts as money because it's part of our social construct. And so it's we can't really say that gold and silver are intrinsically money. They're money in our society, in our system, but not necessarily universally. And so in the same sense, Bitcoin may appear worthless in certain contexts or certain economies, but in other economies, it can have value because of the social nature of money itself. So I know that's sort of a long-winded way of saying money is much more contingent than we might think. And so we have to look at the utility value of the money. The thing about cryptocurrencies is it's mathematically limited. And so that's a feature that fiat currencies don't have. And so you could say that's similar to gold in that there's a finite amount of gold. There's still some in the ground to be dug out. It certainly can't be created in infinite quantities. The other part of it, though, is the means of exchange, the utility value. And gold just, I couldn't really pay somebody in South America with gold. I would have to have an account in which gold was represented by a fiat currency and then go through that whole commotion, right? I wasn't really going to pay somebody with a sliver of gold. And so, you know, gold works well as a store of value.
I'd like to share a comment by probably in the top of the investment realm. He's a true intellectual and now a professor, and Nassim Taleb, fooled by randomness and so many others, anti-fragility, black swan, how could I forget? He points out that this can no way be a bubble. In fact, he notes that it's mathematically an impossibility for Bitcoin to be in a bubble, although I agree with you, there's an awful lot of signs that might say otherwise, and simply points out that there's no number that you could rule out here, that it could drop just as quickly to 5,000 as it could fly to 100,000. You might say one of the financial world's greatest skeptics. He doesn't believe in really owning anything that has any risk at all, claiming that this could be a $100,000 Bitcoin.
I'm so glad you brought him up because, as you say, as a skeptic of all things conventional, you really have to pay attention to what Taleb says and at least analyze it and put it through the mill. You can't just reject it out of hand. And so I think that's my pitch to everybody who is currently convinced that this whole crypto thing is just a bubble that's gonna go away. Look beneath the surface before you reject the whole thing as a bubble.
Final, just mini question for you. I'm sure you were around during the dot-com frenzy, 97, 98, 99, 2000. Are we 95, 96, or the summer of 99?
Yeah, it feels a lot like the end of the quarter four of 1999. Like we're a quarter or two away from the blow off top and the end of the euphoria.
Any parting comments and or contact information?
Well, Chris, I really appreciate a chance to talk about one of my favorite topics, which is cryptocurrencies, and we've hardly touched the surface really. Come visit me at oftwominds.com. Everything's free.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
John Embry, the precious metals portfolio management specialist since 63 and recovering from a early winter season illness. So we're lucky to have him here today. Welcome back, John Embry.
Well, it's Great to chat with you, Chris, as always. Well, you know, I think we're in one of these positions, Chris, that, I mean, if these things ever get ahead of steam, they're just not going to be stopped. I mean, I think they're either going to be held down like they have been for a long time, or they're going to explode. The problem with their exploding from the view of the powers that be is that the whole monetary policy will be revealed for the utter fraud it is, and interest rates would rise appreciably. So you can understand why they're being relentlessly held down. And I think the true story is being told by the cryptocurrencies, which, as you know, have exploded in price and are telling you what the real fate of fiat currency is, and that is it's going to be destroyed before this is over.
Yeah, it's interesting you should mention that. Max Keiser brought up that he thinks, you know, some of the cryptocurrencies could actually help to liberate gold from this price suppression schemes, because whether or not you really buy the whole suppression thesis or not, it certainly doesn't look good on paper, what we've seen with the exchanges. And as transparency returns to the markets and opacity starts to dissipate, do you agree with some folks that cryptos as maybe a model for what might happen in the coming months and years ahead for gold and silver?
I mean, I think the cryptos have told the true story over the last several years. And now they're in, as you know, an explosive stage. I'm always a little nervous when things move as fast as this. But nevertheless, I think I would, if I were sort of managing somebody's money, I would be moving my crypto, some of my crypto profits over into gold and silver. The real tale on silver is the most interesting. And that is that it is probably trading well below what it costs to dig out of the ground by a pure silver producer. It's a product which is used, two-thirds of it is used in really important applications. It's ridiculous that it's trading at, you know, less than a third of the price it was trading at 6 years ago. And at the same time, somebody is short well over a year's production. The whole thing just doesn't pass the smell test at all. And I think the silver story is the one, the most explosive in the world today. But, you know, it's funny. Like, as you know, they've always said silver's poor man's gold. And, I mean, gold has had its own struggles. But I'm well aware of wealthy people globally that are accumulating gold surreptitiously. They're not making a big issue about it. Whereas silver is poor man's gold. And basically, the average guy in America is basically looking at cryptocurrencies and an explosive stock market and what have you. And basically, silver's fallen off the radar, and so you got the perfect thing. It's extraordinarily underpriced, and the sentiment is terrible. And this is generally the precursor to a big move.
A couple other interesting metrics I just actually read last night. Firstly, and I think this is not really talked about even in the precious metal circles by the gold and silver crowds, although silver is clearly at least obviously the most abundant of the two precious metals, the available investment grade silver is actually half that of gold. Of course, we have to be really careful when using fundamentals to determine price, but I think when you add in here, there's several major constraints here on supply, virtually giving it away. Less of it for investment purposes above ground than there is gold available, at least currently, at current prices and stockpiles.
If money wanted to get exposure in silver, they couldn't do it. There just isn't enough.
But if I had a piggy bank filled with silver today, I wouldn't be as quick during a price rise to sell that silver or trade it in for dollars, whereas some of these digital currencies, which we're actually a big fan of here, are so easily spent electronically. It's not easy to electronically spend your precious metals. They have a tendency to stick around in people's safes.
I think they're going to, but as I said earlier, the major impediment is the powers that be know that if gold and silver prices were to explode, it would unmask the entire, you know, monetary policy globally as being just grossly inflationary. And in fact, that it hasn't shown up dramatically in everyday goods. It's all going into financial assets. And I mean, bonds are ludicrously overpriced. They're historically extremely overpriced. Real estate in attractive areas possibly aspire to a house at these levels. And I mean, so it's all being reflected. And yet, so far, they've been able to keep interest rates down. And as I said, I'm shocked that people actually would hold bonds, particularly some of the lesser quality bonds that are going to default anyways, at the lousy interest rates they're being given. Chinese and the Russians and what have you, they are, you know, very quietly accumulating massive quantities of gold, particularly the Chinese, and they're lying through their teeth about how much they have. And I think there will be a time when gold is reintroduced into the system, not by North Americans or the Western world, but by the Eastern world that has basically accumulated all this gold.
So you expect that shift from the West to the East to continue?
No question. And as soon as they can't get any more at these bargain prices, then I think there's a very strong probability the price will be marked up.
It kind of leads to the next question. You talked about paper assets. Obviously, there's a huge sea and ocean between tangible assets. They certainly seem relatively undervalued.
They're actually staggeringly undervalued. I mean, gold and silver and platinum, I should throw platinum in there, it's equally as abused, but they're extraordinarily inexpensive. And then you can sort of look at the flip side of tangible assets. How about art? How about that Da Vinci, which is a terrible painting, selling for $450 million?
Right, I believe a Saudi Arabian prince purchased for nearly $500 million, a Da Vinci. I mean,
billion, and it's sort of a depiction of some aspect of Christianity.
I can't think of a better individual from history, you know, to own a piece of artwork other than Da Vinci. I mean, what a remarkable individual. I mean, the true Renaissance man. John Embry, just great to hear your thoughts today. And if you could please tell our listeners a bit more about Sprott Asset Management and any other contact information.
We're sort of a two-headed company now. We're now Sprott Inc., and we're doing primarily, you know, precious metals-related business. And sort of the money management side has been effectively sold. And we manage gold funds and gold, you know, what have you. So, I mean, if you're interested in that subject, get in touch with Sprott.
All right, John Embry, I want to wish you happy holidays and a very Merry Christmas to you and your family.
And same to you, Chris, and we'll talk to you in the new year.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you back with us today at GoldSeek.com Radio and our featured guest, Chris Powell, Secretary Treasurer of the Gold Antitrust Committee, GATA.org, working with, of course, Bill Murphy and others trying to get to the bottom of all of this market rigging and manipulation. Welcome back, Chris Powell.
Oh, thanks.
Chris, you've been invited to several conferences and talks around the world. I mean, you're obviously in demand. Folks are intrigued. Really, the cognoscenti want to know just what's going on with this rigging and manipulation. And there's oftentimes a lot of confusion around the topic, and you've done a great job organizing your thoughts. I thought we'd start today with your extensive research into the Deutsche Bank price rigging case, where they paid $60 million to settle a U.S. suit.
Deutsche Bank has admitted conspiring to rig both the gold and silver markets and has offered to pay, I think, about $98 million to plaintiffs in that suit. New York, I think, more interesting, Deutsche Bank has also agreed to provide evidence against its co-conspirator market traders in gold and silver. It has, you know, implicated, HSBC and Societe Generale. So there's going to be a lot of follow-up here, unless the U.S. government can stop the case, and indeed the U.S. government is trying to stop the case. It has urged the judge in New York to postpone any further evidence finding until the Justice Department can begin its own investigation of gold and silver market rigging by Deutsche Bank. And this is pretty funny because, of course, for many years, the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission insisted that it was investigating rigging in the silver market and couldn't find anything. So now somebody has found something, has gotten voluminous admissions. The U.S. government has come in to try to stall the case, and I imagine the government is trying to do that because eventually the rigging investigation will incriminate the U.S. government as well.
You know, you did mention, I believe, $38 million in a silver suit.
We don't know for sure, but since the CFTC, which is supposed to regulate the commodity markets, has sat on its hands about gold and silver rigging, no matter how much evidence is produced of it, one has to suspect that the CFTC has determined that the rigging of the gold and silver markets is actually U.S. government policy and that the government is implementing this policy through intermediaries in order to keep its
fingerprints off what's going on in the markets. That makes sense to me. I mean, I can't prove that today. I can prove only that Deutsche Bank has confessed and incriminated the other bullion banks. But the U.S. government does claim the power very formally to intervene secretly and rig any market in the world, and it indeed is authorized to rig any market in the world by the Gold Reserve Act of 1934, as amended in the 1970s. You can see this on the Treasury Department's internet site, the page for the Exchange Stabilization Fund. The Treasury Department claims the power to secretly rig any market in the world, and the Congress has given it that power. So I think our suspicion here about what's really going on is pretty valid. I attended in 2001 a hearing in one of our lawsuits against gold and silver market rigging. The case was brought against the Bank for International Settlements and the Treasury Department and the Fed and some other bullion banks. The single hearing on it was held in U.S. District Court in Boston. And an assistant U.S. attorney got up and, in supporting a motion for summary judgment dismissal of the case, said that the government was indeed authorized to rig any market in secret, or market in secret anyway. I mean, this is a matter of public record. Anybody can look this up. The government has the power to intervene secretly in any market and rig it. What we try to do is call attention to this, that there are really no markets anymore. There were only interventions by the government, that we're losing our market economy, we're losing our democracy, our transparency in government. And the struggle that GATA is waging here, I think, is essential to things far bigger than the mining industry and the financial markets. I think it's our struggle is crucial to democracy and limited transparent government.
You do talk about the Bank of International Settlements, referring to it as the central bank of central banks, and the oversight, if you will, of our friendly central bankers at Fed and around the world, the BOJ, the Bank of England, and related banks. And what I found interesting here is that they're getting involved in the swap business. You didn't delve into this too deeply yet. I mean, obviously, these gold swaps give them power and their agents to manipulate gold and the, of course, paper derivatives all around the world. And I think that it was implied here the BIS could be using this enormous power or influence to sway the markets when they start to get out of hand, when the people start to realize, wait a minute, there's an imbalance in the precious metals market. I'd better procure some.
The BIS is the gold broker for the major central banks. Our consultant, Robert Lamborn, pays very close attention to their monthly and annual reports, and if you go through the reports of the BIS, you find that they are very active in the gold business. You also find, as Bob did, that for some months until late last year, the BIS had gotten out of the gold swap business and then returned to it in a big way. Well, there's only one explanation for that, and that's central banks needed to allocate gold around the world in certain markets to control the price. You know, this is another matter of public record. The BIS is the gold broker for central banks, and the central banks are trading the gold market. Well, to quote Alexandre Gauthier, the director of market operations for the Bank de France, the Bank of France is active in the gold market, quote, nearly on a daily basis, quote, for its own account and for the accounts of other central banks. They're trading in the market for a purpose. Now, either this purpose is just to have fun, to see which central bank can make more money by speculating the market, or else there's another purpose to it, which would be controlling the currency markets, controlling the gold market, to rig those markets in defense of government currencies and government bonds. Unfortunately, the financial news media will never put a question, a specific question, about this market intervention to any central bank, even though it's public record. This is a a prohibited subject, and unfortunately the mining industry itself is not interested in it.
Well, they may feel that it's just an issue beyond their control. I mean, whereas GATA has actually picked up the ball here and made, I think, a rather valiant and courageous effort to expose what's going on. And you discuss several researchers, advocates around the world, who have made attempts at several different locations to try and, let's just say, nail down how much bullion is actually in these central banks. How much of these reserves actually exist, and how much of it is just paper shenanigans?
I'm just going to try to give credit to two researchers, particularly Koos Janssen of Bullion Star and Ronan Manley, who also writes for Bullion Star. They have peppered central banks with questions over the last few years. And usually they get the door slammed in their face. If you put a specific question about gold market activity to central banks, they will not be candid with you. They will not answer answer the question. I think that's, you know, really pretty telling. But I have said for, you know, many years that central banks, or governments anyway, treat their gold reserve information as more sensitive than the plans for the construction and deployment of nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons really can't be used except to destroy the world, but central bank gold is used to rig markets and control the world everywhere. It's a much more effective weapon than nuclear weapons.
It's an intriguing parallel. The destructive power of a thermonuclear device and the destructive power of the central bank's ability to print endless money and manipulate these markets. And you also talk about another researcher here who was looking into Mexico's central bank and their reserves, evidently a unallocated account at the Bank of England. This sounds suspicious. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, Guillermo Barber is a financial journalist in Mexico who has also tried to put very specific questions to central banks about gold. He questioned the Mexican central bank about its gold reserves, and of course they put him off. But Barber prompted the National Mexican Audit Office to prod the Bank of Mexico about its gold reserves, and a few weeks ago the Bank of Mexico did issue a report about its gold reserves that showed that most of Mexico's official gold was being held at the Bank of England, and a fair amount of it was held in what's called an unallocated account, which signifies that, you know, the specific gold is not there. It's just a liability that the gold has been lent or swapped out. So Barba really provoked action in Mexico to expose that the Bank of Mexico is participating in gold loans or gold swaps to help keep the gold price down. I wish there were more like Barbara Janssen, Manley, who would keep pressing the central banks about what they're doing in the gold market, though I'm confident there's so much evidence are in on the gold price suppression scheme, and I suspect it's because the U.S. economist Paul Brodsky and Lee Quaintance were right when they wrote a paper 5 years ago speculating that the central bank scheme right now is to redistribute world gold reserves in favor of the holders of large U.S. dollar foreign exchange surpluses, so that when the dollar is devalued, the countries holding dollars will be hedged by an increase in the price of gold that has been redistributed to them.
Well, you know, you have plenty of company who obviously share your sentiments here. Dirk Bauer, professor of accounting and finance at the University of Western Australia, certainly shares your sentiments. There has been rigging in the gold market.
Two papers on this. I guess his most recent paper was an update of his first paper, but he looked at gold swaps and leases and concluded that these indeed were the mechanisms by which central banks are controlling the gold price. They are, you know, basically injecting phantom paper gold into the market through these swaps and leases. And he concluded that this was the mechanism of gold price suppression and market rigging. So there's a really an academic study that in the last year that supports GATA's conclusions. You know, I don't think Bauer is going to get a lot of publicity for it either, because, you know, it's a prohibited subject no matter who gets into it. But, you know, there is an academic study from a respected professor in Australia that concludes that Gatta is right. Central banks are rigging the gold market, and they're using gold swaps and leases to do it.
According to your notes here, former Fed head Alan Greenspan told Congress, do not worry, or at least that was, again, the implications of his speech about the gold price. And the central bank has it all under control. We can sleep well at night knowing that our money supply and our markets are free. We don't have to worry about counterparty operations and things of that matter. Again, this just seems to be counter to your thesis.
Greenspan went before Congress in July 1998. He was testifying on legislation to start regulating derivatives. And interestingly, Greenspan was urging Congress not to regulate derivatives. And he had a very telling reference about gold. He said that they didn't have to worry about anybody cornering the gold market because central banks stand ready to lease gold in increasing quantities should the price rise. That is, Greenspan told Congress that they didn't have to worry about gold derivatives because the central banks were using gold derivatives to control the gold market. Nobody else was going to control the gold market but central banks, and the Congress should leave gold derivatives regulation alone because that was a mechanism that central banks themselves were using to corner the gold market. You know, that testimony is still on the Federal Reserve's own internet site. Greenspan admitted that the purpose of gold leasing was not what some central banks and their apologists were saying, to make a little money on a supposedly dead asset. Rather, the purpose of gold leasing, Greenspan told Congress, was to keep the price down. That's intervention. You know, that's market rigging. And Greenspan himself testified to it. But when Gatta tries to call attention to this, we're called conspiracy theorists.
Evidently, it's not just Gatta who doesn't trust their government. Maybe a billion folks in India as well. You make an interesting case here. Indians have refused, most of them, to paperize, you call it, their gold, turning down this opportunity that the government has extended to them to receive paper money in place of their gold. Only 7 tons of the 24,000 tons actually were drawn out, if you will.
Yeah, the Indian government has been waging war on gold for decades. Indian people, you know, have a great affinity for gold as wealth and as savings. The Indian government finds this very difficult because it impairs the Indian government's ability to inflate the currency. The Indian people don't really think very much of the rupee. So the Indian government over the last year has proposed various schemes to urge Indians to bring their gold forth to banks and exchange the banks for gold bonds. And those gold bonds are not paying very much in the way of interest. The Reuters reported a few weeks ago that, you know, only 7 tons of gold had been brought forth in India to get into these gold bond programs. And there's 24,000 estimated tons of gold in India. And I just can't help but thinking that India is a developing country. It's poor, but it has great potential. Think of how wealthy India would be instead of a poor country if a fair free market price was allowed for the 24,000 tons of gold that's in private hands and temple possession in India. But instead, the government of India cooperates with the West in suppressing the gold prices as best it can, and that really keeps the Indian people poor.
Along with the recent decision of the Prime Minister there to eliminate their lowest currency denominations, which hamstrung the nation because, you know, as you probably know, 80-90% of daily transactions occur through cash and not electronically, as we see here in the United States. So I'd like to move on to your notes to the Federal Reserve. And you finally received a formal response, apparently, from the Federal Reserve that the Fed would refuse to disclose most of its information on the swap arrangement, gold swaps.
Yeah, a few years ago, we made requests to the Fed for access to its gold related documents. We were concentrating particularly on gold swaps. We we got a letter from a member of the Fed's Board of Governors, Kevin M. Warsh, who was acting as a sort of hearing officer on our request. And Warsh wrote to our lawyer that among the documents that the Fed was refusing to disclose to us were records of gold swap arrangements the Fed has with foreign banks. And these arrangements were information, Warsh wrote, that was not, you know, typically disclosed to the public. Well, that was an admission back, I guess it was 2009, that the Fed was involved in gold swaps. More recently, a year ago, March, a GATA supporter was in the audience when the president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, Bill Dudley, was speaking at Virginia Military Institute. And at the end of Dudley's address, he took questions. Well, our supporter in the audience, Ware Smith, first asked Dudley a question about Germany's repatriating its gold from the New York Fed. Dudley answered that question in, at some length for a minute or so, talking about the Fed's relationship with the Bundesbank and why the Bundesbank might want its gold repatriated. Then Smith asked Dudley whether the Fed was involved in gold swaps. Dudley was taken aback for a second and said very dismissively that, well, he couldn't comment on individual customer sort of transactions. You know, this was pretty funny because with Ware Smith's first question, Dudley talked at length about an individual customer transaction between the New York Fed and the German Bundesbank about gold repatriation. But when Smith asked the general question of Dudley, is the Fed involved with gold swaps, Dudley wouldn't answer and mischaracterized the question as an individual customer kind of transaction. That was very telling. Smith brought the exchange to my attention very quickly, and I wrote to the New York Fed's publicists and asked, you know, did Dudley respond this way at the Virginia Military Institute? And I'd like to put the question to you on my own behalf. Is the Fed involved with gold swaps? Well, the New York Fed's publicist got back to me very quickly, and he sent me a link to the video of Dudley's address at Virginia Military Institute, which carried at the end the question and answer exchange. But the Fed's publicist refused even to acknowledge my question, is the Fed involved with gold swaps? So I think you can see that this is the key sensitive question that the U.S. government does not want pursued. That is the Federal Reserve involved with gold swaps as part of a bigger scheme of rigging the gold market? This cannot be answered. The question cannot even be acknowledged. You know, if we had financial journalism in the Western world, this would be a very productive line of pursuit.
Well, no, to corroborate that with your comments on the Canadian billionaire Frank Gustreth, a confidant you mentioned of several really top folks, and a billionaire, very influential individual, and I believe a gold mining company executive, said the governments are suppressing the gold price. Puts a big question mark there, I think, in all of our minds. If the top folks are familiar with this scheme and with these operations, you know, what does it mean for the rest of us Lilliputians out here?
In terms of the mining industry, I mean, this guy did acknowledge, managed was the word he used. He was speaking at the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference back in January. He was being questioned by Marin Katusa, who's a fund manager, and Katusa asked him, why isn't the gold price so much higher with all the turmoil in the world? And Justra said that, well, he thought that the gold price was being managed by governments and investment banks. The interesting thing to me is that Katusa didn't follow up with any question, and Justra didn't volunteer an answer as to, well, what are we going to do about this? We're just going to sit here and take it? Here you guys are in the mining industry. Are you going to just sit there quietly and let the price of your product be suppressed? Do you not care about any obligation to your investors? You know, unfortunately, that question didn't get pursued. But I was very heartened by Schuster's acknowledgement that he had come to think that the gold market is being rigged by governments. I tried to get Schuster's attention, I don't know, I think it was 8, 9, 10 years ago. A mutual friend introduced me to him by email, but I couldn't get him to look at the documents that I sent him. He had all this stuff available to him many, many years ago, but Okay, he's come around, better late than never. The problem is, what is the gold and silver mining industry going to do about this? Anything, or are they just going to sit there and take it for as long as it lasts?
Well, you know, one wonders just what they can do. I mean, if we look at the size, I read an article just last night that pointed out the size of the entire precious metals mining shares. Just one company in the blue chip companies here could buy up the majority of the mining companies, you know, just their cash that they have on hand.
As long as the world is going to let investment banks, bullion banks, governments and central banks issue pieces of paper that say gold and silver on them in place of the metal. If the world is going to accept imaginary gold and silver as equal to real gold and silver, then real gold and silver are worth nothing. You know, why should the whole gold and silver mine industry be, worth anything? Especially if the industry will not stand up for itself against this fabrication of its product.
I think that all investors and our listeners today really owe GATA.org, a debt of gratitude for this coordinated effort that you all have made for, I want to say, over 15 years, maybe approaching 20 years now, to expose this, because we're all beneficiaries. Okay, anyone who has a modicum of investment in this area really should give a hat tip to GATA.org and to everyone there. As we wrap up today, have I missed any topicality that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I would just urge people, if they're interested in this sector, to go to our internet site, GATA.org, and they could enroll for our dispatches in the top right column, where the nonprofit 501c3 organization of the United States. We exist on charity. If people want to support us, they can always go to the How to Help page on our internet site, and they can credit card us a donation or send us a check. Can guarantee you, if you send us $5, you'll have sent us five more dollars than Newmont Mining has.
You know, we have some very loyal listeners today, so I feel confident that that will happen over time. All right, Chris Powell at GATA.org. Again, hat tip, and we appreciate all you're doing for us.
Thanks for your help.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. The United States and much of the world is involved and in your face, waging the largest undeclared war in human history. This is not a military war. It is an information war, where political and financial narratives, both real and imaginary, have been weaponized, where truth, integrity, and the rule of law have been obfuscated, marginalized, and violated, all in an attempt to conquer and own the most sovereign and fertile territory that remains on this planet. The noise you cannot seem to escape is the battle for your mind. Political and public opinion polling has been corrupted by oversampling one demographic at the expense of another, and reporting skewed results that attempt to create news instead of report it, and ultimately influence your beliefs and actions. And then, when your actions and beliefs can't be sufficiently changed, those who are desperately battling for your mind simply cheat, and then lie and deny as they look straight into the camera and tell you otherwise. Bitcoin rhetoric has also reached a deafening proportion. Experts whose opinions and credentials I have valued over the years are vehemently arguing amongst themselves in public. Reports have surfaced that allege some people are taking out mortgages on their homes to buy Bitcoin. It reminds me of the stories that many a financial expert have adapted as their own, in which they discuss getting out of the dot-com bubble in the late 1990s, ahead of the crowd. The theme of those stories is that they met a cab driver, a maid, or some other person who told them how they were going to get rich in technology stocks, and then decided at that moment that the market was perhaps a bit too frothy. I recall about a year and a half before the dot-com crash, Warren Buffett announced he was exiting the technology market for a while because he didn't understand it or the new economy we were supposedly in at that time. The media pounced on him in that moment as being an old man who was out of touch with modern economics. The most ferocious battles are waged for your mind and your money. You must fight to protect them both. As we approach 2018, a resolution to consider may be to cancel your cable TV subscription and retain an internet-only subscription, so you can choose and focus on only those news sources and experts that you actually trust, by controlling the input you allow into your thought process, and begin to short-circuit the powers that be as they continue to wage war in the battle for your mind. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.